America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Andy Block, former MIT Blackjack team member, also professional poker player, World Series of Poker bracelet winner. Andy being on tonight is good news and bad news. He was in a tournament today at the World Series, and if the only way he could be on was to bust out early. And so as his friend, we were hoping he won the sucker, and Munchkin and I have prepared to talk without him. We're also glad to have him, but sorry he busted out. So, Andy Block, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
It's good to be on. Well, it's not so good to be on. I would have preferred to actually have some chips and have a chance at another bracelet, but it's a good second chance.
How far did you get?
Finished like 70-something out of about 210, so not too far. We weren't that close to the money yet.
All right. Now, a few weeks ago, Richard and I were talking about some of the things to do if you're a young player considering turning pro. Don't do it. All right. Well, we're actually going to ask you about it kind of quickly. We got to an interesting email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com from a listener who calls himself WRX, who brought up some excellent points concerning age that we hadn't specifically considered. So, Richard, how does this affect Andy?
Well, when we were first talking about it, I had said that if somebody was going to do this, it's really better to do it when you're young and you don't have any kind of commitments or attachments. And one of the things that WRX brought up was that in some professions, and the example he used was law school.
Or medical school.
Pardon me?
Or medical school.
A big law firms are looking to hire the people fresh out of college, and they're not as interested in somebody who maybe has gone through law school, passed the bar, but now taken 3 or 4 years off, doing this gambling thing. So, Andy, I thought since you went through law school and then went out and did the gambling thing, what do you think about that?
There's some truth to that. I mean, if you take off after college or you don't graduate college, and the gambling thing doesn't turn out, or you get bored by it, or you feel like you just want more from your life, now you've got to go back to school. And people, future employers are just going to look at that and say, hey, why? Why did that happen? Of course, now with poker on TV, it's not such a stigma. It's not necessarily a negative. Especially if you had, some winning years under your belt, and you can show that you were successful at it. And if your future job is something involving finance, it actually can look good on your resume. But think long and hard before you decide to take the plunge. You can always do both at the same time. You can play poker over the summer. If you live in a place where online poker is legal, you can play online while you're going to school. And then, you have a backup career and you have other things that make you more interesting, too, and make you more marketable if that's what the kind of route that you want to go.
The young player that actually prompted our initial conversation was thinking more about getting into blackjack and other forms of, advantage play, so more a table games player. That's a little bit harder to do, than poker is to do part-time. Because you're constantly on the road and it's just a tougher nut to crack, especially without the access to online play.
I think it can be easier. There's just way more opportunities. Obviously, you know, you might not be able to play as much online. You might have to actually go into the casino, but in playing poker, you've got to go into the poker room. You got to spend a lot of hours. I think blackjack is way, it can be more flexible. I put myself through law school with my earnings from the MIT blackjack team. Of course, a lot of that was from my investment, and you know, only about half of that was from my actual playing with the team. So you know, you can do more than one thing at the same time. You don't have to only gamble. And in fact, I wouldn't recommend it. You want to have some other source of income, just in case things don't go well. There's just so much risk involved, even if you play a perfect game.
Yeah, so now you brought up the MIT team. You recently gave a presentation at the International Conference on Gaming about the MIT team. And so could you tell our listeners about what the International Conference on Gaming is and what your presentation was about?
Yeah, the International Conference on Gambling and Risk-Taking, I think it's called. I think this was like the 15th annual, and I think it's the first time it's actually been held here in Las Vegas. It used to be held up in Reno, and the organizers of it here, they teach a class, where they have taught a class called The Sociology of Gambling, and they've had me in a couple of times for their class talking about blackjack, and they thought this would be a good opportunity for me to talk a little bit about the blackjack team. The title of the talk was the MIT team 15 years later. Now, of course, the team really started probably 15 years even before that, 30 years, maybe even longer. I mean, it's hard to put a definitive date and location when the team started. And I got involved with the team around almost 20 years ago. Around 1993, 1994, and played for about 6-7 years, earning about $100,000 a year. But what came out in the talk is that there's a wide variety of people's experience on the MIT team. Some people made very little, might have only played for 6 months, and some people like me might have played a longer period of time. You pretty much got out of it what you put into it. But the consensus amongst the three panelists, which is myself, Henry Ho, who was actually in the movie 21 as a blackjack dealer, and John Chang, who was only on by video because he's been 86 from seizures, and they wouldn't let him come in to talk in person. So our consensus was that
James Grosjean also normally presents academic papers at the conference, and he also, because he'd been 86, did not present this year.
Yeah, they were a little bit stricter than, or a lot stricter than they've been in the past. And I hope that they don't continue doing that. I mean, this is somewhat of an academic conference, and I think it's pretty wrong for card counters to be barred from the conference. It's really, you know, part of it is about that.
But, right, yeah.
You know, leaving that aside, you know, the three of us, we pretty much agreed that as a team, as a business, the MIT team really wasn't that successful. Yes, we made, you know, a lot of money, but when you really break it down, how many hours we spent, how many people were involved, and you compare it to how much the casinos have made over the years, or even how much they made on the movie about us, we made maybe $10 million over the course of like 10, 15 years with dozens and dozens of people who have come and gone through that period of time. And the movie, I think, grossed like $100 million or something. And the book, I don't know how much Ben Mezrich made from the book. He probably made off more of the book than any of us made from the MIT team and the movie deal. I mean, it was successful in some sense. We did put the fear into casinos, and they had, you know, took on some extra countermeasures, not just because of us, but of the other teams that are out there playing. But when it comes down to it, you know, blackjack, I'm quoting John Chang here, you know, blackjack is really like an internship. You know, you're learning things that you can use to apply to something else, apply to real business where you can really make the big money. And you know, looking at the, like, the list of companies that have roots or some of the founders or some of the key people that were connected to MIT Black Tech team. And, you know, it starts with companies, little companies like Microsoft. You know, it just goes on from there. You know, the companies that people have started, dozens and dozens of companies that, that people have started, hedge funds that have been managed by people from the MIT team or other people that were involved in Blackjack. So you should not look at Blackjack as, you know, a permanent career, but I think it's a good way of earning money and learning some things. It's hard to learn other ways.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great jumping off point for other businesses. And as John pointed out, it's really small potatoes compared to what you can jump into from the things you learn from playing blackjack and running a successful team.
Let's go to poker.
It is World Series time, after all.
There's currently a really big poker event in Macau with $130,000 U.S. buy-in and a $4.5 million first place prize. And some really big names are over there who would normally be at the World Series. They're over in Macau. Now, is this usual for big events to go head-to-head at the same time as the World Series?
This is pretty unusual. And there's a couple of big events, and this being one of it, or the biggest one, at least in terms of buy-in. And I think there's, I guess, two explanations for it. One is, you know, that was the time that they wanted to do it. And I think the second is, PokerStars, I think, is like the sponsor of it. And, you know, they know that there's going to be competition with the World Series of Poker when the World Series of Poker opens up their online site in the U.S., in Nevada, you know, sometime in the next month or so. So, you know, they're not worried about competing with the WSOP, or they want to, like, send a message to them, I think, and say, hey, you know, you're not the only game in town. And I think that kind of competition could be good for the players. If the WSOP, if they start have the attitude that they have to earn the players and they have to really try and work hard to attract the players, I think it'll improve and for everybody. I think they've been a little bit complacent with you know, the high rake and some of the other issues and some of the rules they have. Actually, like this interview, there's actually a rule 40, I think, that, you know, if you criticize the WSOP, basically, you could get a penalty. But I guess I'm not actually in a tournament at the moment, so I guess I can't get a penalty. So I could say be a little bit critical.
Uh-huh. Are you going to enter another tournament tonight?
Tomorrow, I think. There's a noon horse tournament. There's no five.
And how many events will you be playing in the series?
I've played about six events so far. I'll probably end up playing about 30 events over the 6 weeks or so of the World Series. There's 60-something events total. A couple of them I don't actually qualify for. Well, at least the seniors event, I'm not 50 years old yet, so I don't qualify for that. And I think technically I could try to play the ladies event, but I don't think I want to.
Right, we talked with Nolan Dalla about the problem with that ladies event, and
he would prefer you don't enter it too.
I think that they should allow men to enter it. I think, though, most of the men enter it for the wrong reasons. I think there are legitimate reasons why a man would want to enter the ladies event, and, you know, I don't want to be the person that says that, you know, that's wrong and they can't enter it. And I think the way they're doing it now, I think, is just ridiculous, where they're claiming it's on the schedule as a $10,000 buy-in, but if you're a female, you get a $9,000 discount, which is just ridiculous way of wording it. And I don't think that would actually hold up if someone were to really challenge it in the court, and neither should it. You shouldn't be able to get around laws, whether you agree with it or not. If that's the law, then you shouldn't be able to get around the law by just playing games with the buy-ins.
Why do you feel that they shouldn't, that men should be allowed to enter the ladies event?
Well, there's several reasons. One reason, let's say a man coming to the World Series just to play the event, and is twice too late, and the only event he can play is the ladies event. Who's going to say, you want to tell that guy, like, no, he can't play? It might be the only event that day, and he can't play it. that seems kind of wrong to me. Or, you know, let's say someone's grandmother was a big poker fan and always wanted to play it, and she told her son or whatever that, like, she wanted him to play, or he wanted to play for her in her memory and give the money to the breast cancer research or something like that. I mean, there's a lot of legitimate reasons, I think, to play in the event.
So do you feel that anyone should be able to enter the media event then, or the senior event?
Well, the media event, I think, is a free roll. The senior event, legally, is a different thing, because you are allowed to restrict based on age in Nevada. There's also the a lot of people say that it's offensive to women that they need their own event and that they can't just. You know, the other thing to me is, like, there really aren't that many men that actually go and try to play it. You know, you have a handful of men out of thousands of women. You know, so what? Let them play it. And then you get the question of, you know, what about the preoperative, postoperative, or, you know, people that cross-dress or whatever. I mean, you're saying they can and can't play it. Is the reel going to, like, look at someone's driver's license and see if it says male or female on it? And, you know, if it says male but they look like they're female, say they can't play?
Huh.
I think that's kind of going a little bit too far.
Now, you finally won your first bracelet last year, right?
Yes, I did.
And how many years have you been playing in World Series events?
Well, I could have started playing, I guess, like 22 years ago, but I only been playing since the first event I played was in 96. So
96.
I've been playing, you know, not every year, though. I didn't play any events in 97 or 98. I only played the main event in 97 and 98. In 99, I didn't play at all because I was trying to graduate law school, and it was, like, during exam. So I missed a few years. I took a couple of years off in the early 2000s. So, you know, maybe it took me 12 years of playing at the World Series. But I didn't play 30 events all those years. Maybe I played 200 World Series events and it finally won one.
Right.
Well, you did come second place.
I should pull it up just to see.
Your second place to Chip Reese in the $50,000 horse event is more prestigious than certain bracelets anyway.
Yeah,
that would certainly
be one to be proud of. I'm wondering how you feel about these bracelets that are given for, you know, on the European tour and these bracelets that are given out in these, you know, World Series events in other countries.
I would also, like, lump into that, like, the $1 million buy-in event and maybe the $111,000 buy-in event this year. You know, giving bracelets to those things really, you know, with so many fewer players in the field, it really changes, like, the chance of somebody winning a bracelet. And they keep adding more bracelet events. There's 60-something regular bracelet events at the World Series, and then there's a handful in WSOP Europe and in Australia. And especially Australia, there's a couple of small tournaments. Phil Ivey's bracelet, I think, was in was mixed games or horse or something like that, and it was like under 100 people. And, you know, I guess in the old days, most of the bracelets were like that size. But now, you know, it's a lot harder to win a bracelet. Now, Daniel Negreanu, he won the main event in Down Under, and I think, you know, with 400-something players or whatever were there in the field, I mean, I think that qualifies more as a real bracelet than a 100-player event where you cash like less than 100,000. But, you know, it's up to the WSOP, and, you know, they have to worry about keeping their own brand and making it less prestigious to win a bracelet. So I don't think they'll go too much further than that. The circuit events, they don't get bracelets out for that. You get a rig. And if they did, you'd have people with, you know, there are people with, like, five or more circuit rings, I think. Especially now where there's, I don't even know how many circuit events they have around the country. Too many, in my opinion, but, you know, if people want to play, then good for Caesars for taking advantage of that.
So online poker is alive in Nevada for a little over a month now. Have you tried the Ultimate Poker experience?
I did try Ultimate Poker. I logged in, and the first time. Sorry, I'm outside. A little helicopter going overhead. Wait a second. Okay. Yeah, I did try Ultimate Poker, and the first hand I played, I got really mad at the software, but I still kept playing. I think they rushed the software out, which was, I think, a good move, because that's why they're out there well before the WSOP. But the software had some bugs and had some, you know, features, or didn't have a lot of certain features. There's some really good, smart people that are now working for them, and I think over the next couple of weeks, couple of months, they're really going to have a top-notch product, probably. I don't think it's going to get any worse. They're only going to get better. And the WSOP, you know, they're a little bit late to the game. I would have thought that they would have made sure that they had this thing running by the WSOP. Right now, you can sign up. They have dozens of people lining the hallways trying to get you to sign up to their site, but you can't go up play it yet. It's going to be weeks, probably, before you can actually play for real money, unless they make another mistake and accidentally open up the real money site.
I believe South Point's also opening within the next few weeks, too. So,
right. Well, South Point had claimed that they were going to be open before the end of the year last year, and then ended up not happening. But we'll see. I think Ultimate Poker was smart to be the first. The WSOP has a name. I think it's going to be hard for anybody else to really make inroads there, but it remains to be seen. And previously in online poker, we kept having these huge fights, and we'd say, like, oh, there's no way that anybody's going to be able to beat them. And we went through multiple different sites. They all seemed to, most of them seemed to have the name of something poker, P, beginning with a P, Paradise Poker, Party Poker. And then you had Poker Stars that went and surpassed them. So we'll see. I wouldn't rule anything out at this point.
What does your crystal ball tell you about the future of online poker in the United States?
There's definitely going to be some kind of interstate poker at some point. I mean, there just has to be, because you need a bigger field to really have the big tournaments and to have enough cash game action. I don't know if there'll be any federal legislation, or if it's just going to be state by state that decides to join up with each other. It really would have been nice if there was a federal legislation and made it easy for players from multiple different states to play with each other. And, you know, hopefully, eventually internationally, too. I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't be able to play with Europeans or Australians or Russians. And that was one of the best things, I think, about online poker, especially for, you know, playing at a low limit. You could be playing with people from all around the world and strike up a conversation with them, and assuming they spoke enough of your language. And, you know, that was always kind of cool. Like, you go and you click on the different avatars, and you see where all the different people were from, and that's something that, you know, we're not going to be able to have in the United States for some time. Hopefully, eventually, we will be able to have that. But, you know, right now, everybody's going to be from Las Vegas or Reno or someplace in Nevada, and that's kind of unfortunate. One thing it will do, though, in the short term, is it will attract people who will come to Nevada just so they can play big online poker tournaments. And I think the WSOP has already announced a bunch of online big tournaments this fall. And I bet there's going to be hundreds of people probably that come to Nevada just to play in those tournaments. The bad part of that is those are going to be the better players. They will tend to be the better players that are going to actually travel to play online poker.
Right.
Well, but they're not going to be playing in the 2-5 games and the 1-2 games. So those games will still be available for local players.
Right.
Andy, I wish I didn't have to ask you this on the air, but I do. I got it. When you texted me tonight, you said you were available until 7:25, which is now. Was that because that's how long you think we wanted to have you, or you have to go somewhere?
I've got to go somewhere. I think I have another 5 minutes probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
So you were never really much of a multi-table grinder online, were you? You're really more of a tournament player?
Well, online I played everything. I didn't really grind a lot, but I did play low limits for fun. You know, people want a chance to play against somebody they've seen on TV, and, you know, sometimes it was fun to do that. Play dollar sit and goes with people that are, you know, one guy I was playing with, he was legally blind, and he had like 15% vision. It was enough that he could actually play poker and play online poker, but really hard for him to get out. He would have to have somebody drive him, basically. And, you know, the nearest casino wasn't that close. And but also, you know, I would sometimes play 2,000, 4,000 horse or mixed games. So, you know, it was pretty much whatever I felt
like. Do you prefer playing online, or do you like the live games?
For cash games, I think I prefer online because you can just come and go when you please. You don't have to drive into the casino. I'm too lazy to just drive 20 minutes to go to the casino to play poker sometimes. I've also had some health issues like the last 6 months, and I would have really loved to have been able to play online poker because I really couldn't go into a casino and play regular poker. I mean, I could have, but it would be really tough. And, you know, that really, to me, just solidifies like how ridiculous it is that we can't go play online poker for people that have any kind of handicap. Or who, you know, for whatever reason, it's hard for them to get to a casino or to go out and to a local cash home game. You know, they should be able to play online poker for $5 a sit and go if they want to. It's just ridiculous that our government should even think about making that illegal. They want to set limits on it and say you can't play for more than, you know, $100, $1,000 or whatever. You know, that's one thing, but stop people from playing $1 sit and go is just—that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, agreed.
We started out the interview tonight talking about you started out in blackjack, and whether a pro should become a professional gambler. It seems to me that becoming a competent blackjack player is worlds easier than becoming a winning poker player. And would you agree with that?
Well, it's easier. It's easier to tell also if you're a competent blackjack player because I could test you and tell you whether or not you're playing a really good game. But in poker, it's really hard to do that because so much depends on how your opponents play. And it's not a basic strategy that you learn in simple counting systems. So, you know, blackjack, yeah, I could teach you the basics in 10 minutes. And then you just need to practice. And then I can, you know, give you a little checkout and tell you that you're good to go. Whereas poker, there's so many levels to learn, even if you're sticking to just one game of poker. And no limit, I could tell you, like, what you should play from what position, pre-flop, which is pretty complicated because there's 169 different hands you could start with and no limit hold them. But, that's more things than in blackjack. And that's just pre-flop. And then you have the flop, and you have the turn, and you have the river. And it depends on your stack size and your opponents and your position and all these other factors. So there's way more to learn in poker. But I think there's way more you can win in poker, possibly. I mean, there are a few people that win millions playing blackjack, but there are more people, I think, that can win that much playing poker.
What's the one piece of advice you would give someone who's trying to learn to play winning poker?
Don't go broke. Know what your bankroll is and play according to your bankroll. And that's something I learned from the MIT team. You know, follow Kelly, only bet proportional to your bankroll and your advantage. Start out small and don't move up in stakes until you win at the lower levels and you can afford it. You know, never put more than like 5 or 10% of your bankroll on the table at one time. Don't buy into a tournament that's a big, you know, more than like 5% of your bankroll, and even that might be too big. So, you know, be a little bit conservative and take your time and never stop learning.
Very good. Those are of the one special point. That was about 7 of them. Thank you.
Don't go broke.
But all good.
Very good. So we thank you very much. So now you have to run and go do whatever else you have to win. So we're sorry you broke out. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, Munch. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
Also, going back to that WRX email, the one thing he talked about was the professional grade when you're young, but he had a couple other points too. One we're going to talk about tonight, and one I think we're going to save until next week. And another point in that email was that older people frequently find that it's time to become a professional gambler. Older meaning when your kids are out of the house and you put in enough years on your job, so maybe you have a pension and maybe your wife is ready to get you out of the house for a while.
Yeah, actually, I thought that was a really good point. When I had talked about doing it when you're young, I mainly was thinking about my own situation and how much my life changed once I had kids. I wasn't thinking so much about job situations, because I was the type of person who really was not going to go work a 9-to-5 job. So, but kids really change your life, and it's very hard to be a professional player and be on the road constantly when you have kids at home. But he really is right. Like, once the kids are old enough that they're off to college, that's a great time to go, go back into playing. And, the most important thing, as Andy just said, is you really, if you're semi-retired or retired, and you're planning on living on that bankroll you have for the rest of your life, you really want to be careful about managing that bankroll. So,
yes, being broke when you're 60 is a much more serious problem than being broke when you're 30.
Yes. Yeah. But there are problems that you have, once you get older. You just don't see as well, and sometimes, there's an awful lot of walking involved. If I'm scouting in Las Vegas, 2 or 3 miles a day is nothing, going in and out of casinos. So you have those issues, but I agree with WRX that it is a great time to go out and really supplement your income. And you tend to get less heat as an older person. It always looks funny when a guy is, 23 years old and he's betting $1,000 a hand or something. They're like, who is this guy and where did he get this money? Whereas if you're 60, it's not a big deal.
All right, let's change the subject. Let's say you and I were going to form a partnership for a weekend to go play some kind of table game at a particular casino. And what would be the parameters for deciding at the end of the play, if we profited, how much you'd get and how much I'd get, or if we lost, how much you would pay and how much I would pay? What kind of parameters would there be to go into that?
Well, that particular situation for me is a pretty easy one, because you have money. So if it were you and I, my deal would be we split at the end of the weekend, we split 50-50, win or lose. If we lose, we both put up half the loss. If we win, we both put up, we split up half the win. Where those deals get tricky is when one person doesn't have any money or a lot of money. And now you have to figure out, or another situation, say you found a game that you're not going to go play, but you want to give it to me. Like, how should you be compensated in that case? And those, those deals are complicated. I mean, it's really hard to figure out what's fair. What is the right way to go about that? I mean, James Grosjean, in his book, Exhibit CAA, has a chapter about the costs of the free roll. Because what a lot of people used to do was say, okay, you told me about the game, so you know, you'll get 10% of the win. And that can actually be a really terrible deal for the guy who's going to play, to give away 10% of the win if it's something where he's not going to get a lot of play. So yeah, these are tough things. Do you have situations like that in video poker? Like if you were going to go play, say, a progressive where you need a really massive bankroll and you want to put together a kind of a team approach?
Probably, and I haven't been a participant in any teams, so I'm not sure what the normal teams are. But back to table games, it could conceivably be you know about the game, you need a partner, and you spend 7 hours teaching me, and then we go down there. And then they do it. Now, somehow you have to be compensated for your knowledge. And in addition...
You know what? I'm interested in being in business with people for a long time. Actually, it was the greatest business lesson I ever got. I used to produce dance shows in Las Vegas to send to Japan.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it'd be six or eight dancers and maybe a singer, sometimes a specialty act. And one time... I had done several shows for this particular theater owner, and he came to Las Vegas, and we sat down, and he asked me if there was any way that I could make the budget less. And I said, if you are happy with the show the way it is, I can't make the budget less unless we cut out, you know, two less dancers or, you know, less costumes or whatever. And then he said to me, "Do you need more money?" And I was flabbergasted.
Don't hear that often.
Yeah, I said, "I don't understand. You just asked me if I could do it for less. What do you now? You're offering me more?" And he said, "I'm interested in being in business with you 50 years from now. And if you're not making enough money, you're not going to remain in business. So if you need more money, just tell me." And I basically said, "Well, no, if you're happy with the show the way it is now, I don't need any more money. If you want the show to be bigger, if you want more dancers, another act, then I would need more money. But if you're happy with it as it is, then I don't." So I'm interested in finding people that I can be in business with for the long term. So if I teach you something or whatever, I don't care. I would still split with you 50-50. You know, if you're somebody I want to be in business with, which if I approach you in the first place, it means I probably do want to be in business with you. And here's the thing that I've found over the years. Eventually, everyone's character is revealed. And I try to surround myself. When people get in trouble is when the unexpected happens. Something that we didn't think about happens, and now what do we do, right? Like, we get held up, right? You get mugged, and somebody steals the money. You know, well, whose fault is it? You know, were you drunk? You know, and what I found is that in moments like that, people's character gets revealed, and I find out whether I want to continue to be in business with that person, because I try to surround myself with people who will handle that situation as fairly as they can for all of us, not think about what's the best for me, what can I get out of this situation. And there are many people who just think that way. They see a situation and think, how am I going to get the biggest cut? And when I find those, you know, that someone is like that, I tend to do less business with them.
You could still be their friend sometimes, but just not do business with them.
Oh, you know, that's another thing that I learned very young. You know, there are some people you can trust with your money and, you know, with your liquor, but not with your wife. And other people, you know, you could trust with your wife and to stay at your house, but you can't trust them with your money. Or, you know, so yeah, there are some people that remain friends, but they're just people that I don't choose to be in business with anymore.
Interesting. Very good. Something happened a while ago while I was teaching a class. And it was an eye-opener to me. It was a Deuces Wild class. And it was the time of the strategy where we were going to discuss where a suited queen jack or a suited queen 10 is in the strategy list. Now, video poker strategy is a top-down hierarchical list, and that you pick whatever instruction comes first. So in most Deuces Wild games, the suited queen jack would not be as good as an open-ended straight like queen jack 10-9, but it would most games would be better than an inside straight queen jack 9-8. So we were discussing it, and I was asking people in the class which is better, queen jack or queen 10. So I asked the first guy which is better, and he says queen jack. Now that is the normal wrong answer. Queen and the jack don't have a gap in there where queen 10 does, but since you're so close to the ace, that gap doesn't matter. And so I also, in games like Double Bonus, a pair of jacks would give you your money back and a pair of tens wouldn't. So in Double Bonus, queen jack is more valuable than queen 10. But in Deuces Wild, I said, no, that's not the right answer. So I asked the next guy, which is more valuable, queen jack or queen 10? And the answer is not queen jack. So he puts a big smile on his face and he says queen 10. I says, very good. That's also the wrong answer. I go down to the third guy. And I said, all right, we're trying to figure out whether queen jack and queen 10, or which is more valuable, and it's not queen jack, and it's not queen 10. And he absolutely could not figure out that the correct answer is that they have equal value. It was logically beyond him. To me, this is a trivial inference. But to him, it was too much. Now, he had been to, I don't know, 10 classes. And after that, maybe another 5. And so he has this goal of becoming a winning player. But there's this rather elementary logic that he doesn't get. So it is, I would not call that mathematical, but people who are good at math will get that easier than people who aren't good at math. So I would predict that particular guy has no chance at all to be a successful gambler.
I don't know if that's true.
Okay.
I mean, because I think video poker is one of the games where as long as you can memorize the strategy and know not to deviate from it, you don't really have to understand it, I don't think, you know. I think he would never be able to be a poker player or something that takes a little more, you know, thought. But you know, I mean, I'm not a video poker player, so maybe there's more to it than but if he could memorize the strategy, even if he didn't understand it, he would be a winning player, right?
That part is true, except my experience is when I understand something, it's a whole lot easier to memorize. And when I don't really understand why, it's like memorizing words in a foreign language. It's much, much harder. So, but you might be right. Let's talk about our sponsors. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. This month, June, players can earn Chevron gas cards at half price. Normally, it takes 8,334 points to earn a $25 cash or free play. Now that number of points gives you a $50 Chevron gas card. There's a limit of 10 cards, which is going to take you 83,000 plus to do. So if you assume that Chevron gas cards are equivalent to money, it's double points for the first $83,000 coin in that you play, which for most players is all they're going to play in a month anyway. Father's Day may or may not have double points. They have not announced it yet, but frequently a holiday like that does get double points at South Point. It will not affect the number of points you need to earn for the Chevron gas cards.
although it will affect the points you have left over. For example, if you played 83,000 on a double point day, you would get the gas cards and still have 83,000 points. If you played 83,000 points on a non-double point day, you'd get the gas card and your points would disappear. So it is still better to play on double point days, but it does not reduce the number of points you need to get a gas card. At the Palms, in Friday and Saturday night, they have drawings for the $127,000 Slots of Steel drawings and tournament. The way it works is the winners Friday and Saturday night in June get some small prizes, and then they come back for a slot tournament on June 30th. And at that slot tournament, you can win up to $52,000. So if you cannot win, if you cannot be here June 30th, the drawings have much less value to you than if you can. There's going to be more drawing tickets in the barrel this month because they have the bingo promotion back again. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, you can fill out cards. So a video poker bingo card would have one square for royal flush, one for a straight flush, a couple on it for regular flushes, another one for four kings, etc. When you fill it in, it's worth a certain amount of money. And there's different values depending on whether you're playing slots or video poker and what the denomination of the game you're playing. There are significant restrictions on what machines apply. The most lucrative game for video poker is probably a 5-play, 25-cent, 9-6 jacks or better. On those machines, of which they have about 20 of them, the bingo promotion adds more than a percent, and this is on top of a 99.54 game with a 0.25 slot play, free play, and mailers and the drawings. PEW, play, earn, and win. Guests for the first half of the month have a theme of stainless. That means stainless silverware, well, stainless flatware, and they have some stainless steel thermoses and paper towels holder. The second half of the month, it's called Booze Cruise, where you can earn liquor and even some soda if you're a non-drinker. At videopoker.com, they have the monthly tournaments. We always tell you what the monthly tournaments are. They also have daily tournaments. So today's daily tournament is called Super Triple Play. Tomorrow's will be Multi-Strike Poker, Saturday's Ultimate X, and Sunday's Super Times Pay Poker. These tournaments are free to enter. The winner gets small prizes, but it gives you a chance to practice the games before you see them in the casino. And so it gives you a way to make more intelligent choices as to what to play. Our guest next week is going to be Mark Andes. Mark is a poker player and a video poker player, but he has a website called Mark's Las Vegas, and where, among other things, he talks about the differences between the M Life slot club system and Total Rewards. And so that's going to be the primary discussion of what we're going to talk about next week with Mark Andes. The following week is going to be Bill Zender. Munch, why don't you tell us who Bill Zender is?
Bill Zender's a really interesting guy. He worked for Nevada Gaming Control as an agent. He worked as a player and in all aspects on the inside of casinos. And now he's a consultant. He's written quite a number of books, but the two most important for our listeners, I think the ones that they would be most interested in, are Card Counting for the Casino Executive and Advantage Play for the Casino Executive. Both of those I highly recommend. We'll be talking to Bill next 2 weeks, right?
Right. Bill is in 2 weeks, and Mark is in 1 week. All right. The there was this law passed and signed by the governor in Nevada within the past week about the device law. The device law is the law that says whether what is legal and illegal to beat the casino with. And so apparently the change in the law now includes the word software into what is considered an illegal device. So presumably you can use a computer if it doesn't have software. So,
well, I think this really applies. Remember, we talked on the show, I guess last year sometime, about using the video poker app to analyze a video poker hand while you're sitting there at the video poker machine. Sounds like this law would definitely cover that. You're using software, right?
Well, I would think so. Now, Bob Nersessian, who's the lawyer who comes on our show periodically, seemed to feel that the law as it was before excluded using those video poker apps. And so I don't know how this one is more. I don't know. We'll have to ask Bob next time he's on. It would seem like using your cell phone in a casino is to tell somebody that the progressive meter is now at 8,200 would be illegal. Obviously, cell phones have quite a bit of software in there. And so...
Yeah, I think this is another case where the law is just so vague that if anybody ever has to test it, you know, it would probably fall. But nobody wants to be the guinea pig to have to to have to pay the expense of testing it.
Yeah, now I'm going to continue to use my cell phone in casinos for normal cell phone purposes, and but I would not use a video poker app.
I was in a casino today and actually looked up a strategy. I literally got off the table and had to check a strategy decision for a game that I, you know, almost never play. And so I, you know, I was using my phone to check on the strategy of the game. I had stood up, you know, before I did it. But so, yeah, I don't know. I wasn't in Nevada, so.
That might make a difference. So at that particular casino, I have been out before, and if you're at a table and your cell phone rings, you actually have to leave the table to answer your call. You cannot
speak. That's most places. Most places you're not allowed to talk on the phone or send a text or even read a text while you're seated at the table for table games.
So why would that be? Why couldn't you read a text?
Oh, because they're
stupid.
We have
about 30 seconds.
I don't know what... Yeah, I don't know what they're afraid of. I mean, you know, yeah, there's no spooking anymore, so it's not like somebody's sending you the dealer's hold card. I don't know why. It
Very
just doesn't
good.
Make any sense.
So thank you, Richard. Good night, everybody. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.